us, we think it's great that the students are going to be vaccinated. We also think the workers should be vaccinated. The university did not reach out to us to talk about this. We think it's important that I certainly think that all my members should be vaccinated. We want a safe campus. We all want a safe campus. Now, how they're going to mandate this and how it's going to work, honestly, there isn't enough transparency between us and the university, so it's hard to know. But from our vantage, faculty certainly skew older, and so we want a safe place if we're going to be in the classroom for our teachers. And so not only should the students be vaccinated, but we want our faculty to be vaccinated as well.
Well, I want to thank... Yes, go ahead, Christine. We have a few seconds.
Just to jump in, we strongly encourage our members to be vaccinated. We are not in support of a mandate for faculty and staff, but we are strongly in support of, we all want a health and safety, health and safe campus to return to, especially as we try to return to post-pandemic life.
Christine O'Connell, president of the Union of Rutgers Administrators, American Federation of Teachers, and Todd Wolfson, Rutgers Union of Grad Workers, Faculty, and Postdocs. Thanks so much for being with us. A happy birthday to Matt Ely. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Are you a KBOO member? Tell us why you support KBOO. Call our listener testimonial line and leave a message telling us why you support KBOO Community Radio. Testimonials will be used on air during our next membership drive. Call 503-231-8032, extension 302. That's 503-231-8032, extension 302. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Commissioners have reached a compromise with Mayor Ted Wheeler on how they plan to deal with gun violence in Portland. The Oregon Legislature passed a striking number of police accountability bills yesterday, and in international news, Brazil reported over 4,000 deaths due to COVID-19 yesterday. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 7th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. City Commissioners Carmen Rubio, Mingus Maps, and Dan Ryan reached a compromise yesterday with Mayor Ted Wheeler on the issue of how to deal with increased gun violence in Portland. Wheeler had initially proposed allocating an additional $2 million to the Portland Police Bureau in what critics say resembled the now-defunct Gun Violence Reduction Team that was disbanded last year. But City Commissioners Rubio, Maps, and Ryan proposed a more community-based approach. Under the new agreement, a special team of uniformed officers would return to take preventative action against gun violence without the additional funding for the PPB. Instead, more money, about $4 million, would be budgeted for community anti-violence work, as well as bringing back about 24 park rangers in an attempt to prevent gun violence in public green spaces. In a press release today, Rubio's spokesperson Will Howell wrote, quote, "Park rangers are unarmed goodwill ambassadors who provide a positive community presence in Portland's parks and neighborhoods." In 2020, Portland experienced nearly 900 shootings, more than double that in 2019. National gun violence data shows this increase in at least a dozen cities across the United States. The new plan will be voted on later today and will not allow for any public testimony or discourse. Yesterday, Oregon legislatures passed 10 police accountability bills through the House Judiciary Committee in a major bipartisan effort. The bills include a directive for investigating officers' backgrounds more thoroughly before hiring them. Also included are bills regulating the types of weapons police can use and requiring officers to have clear identification on their uniforms when working in a crowd. One of the bills would create a public database with information about officers' misconduct and discipline, a database civil rights lawyers in Oregon have long said is necessary. After the bills passed through committee, the House Republican caucus released a statement praising the committee's work. The Oregon Health Authority reported 544 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 167,658. Oregon health officials also reported 33 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 2,427. Governor Kate Brown announced Tuesday that both Multnomah and Clackamas counties would return to the high-risk COVID classification starting Friday, April 9th. The move comes as case counts and hospitalizations have increased throughout several parts of the state. The counties will remain in the high-risk category for at least the next 2 weeks. On Monday, frontline workers and their families became eligible in Oregon for a vaccine, along with people 16 and older with underlying health conditions and those living in multi-generational households. And starting April 19th, all Oregonians over the age of 16 will be eligible to receive a vaccine. President Biden has stressed that while the U.S. is now vaccinating a record number of Americans, the battle against COVID-19 is far from won as cases are once again on the rise. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 30.8 million cases of COVID-19 and at least 556,000 deaths. So far, at least 32% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, with 19% of the population fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 132 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.8 million people have died across the world. The White House has expanded COVID-19 vaccine eligibility, and starting April 19th, all adults in the U.S. will be eligible to receive a vaccine. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
By no later than April 19th, in every part of this country, every adult over the age of 18 or older will be eligible to be vaccinated.
That's 2 weeks earlier than President Joe Biden's initial deadline. On Tuesday, Biden also announced he's on track to meet his goal of 200 million shots by his 100th day in office, with 150 million administered during his first 75 days. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the government will not support a vaccine passport system.
As these tools are being considered by the private and nonprofit sectors, our interest is very simple from the federal government, which is Americans' privacy and rights should be protected.
Both Texas and Florida have executive orders banning the use of COVID vaccine passports. The storm over Georgia's new voting law is still brewing. When asked about Major League Baseball pulling the All-Star game out of Atlanta, Biden said Georgia needs to, quote, smarten up, unquote, to prevent companies from leaving.
When they, in fact, move out of Georgia, the people who need the help the most, people who are making hourly wages, sometimes get hurt the most. I think it's a very tough decision for a corporation to make or a group to make. But I respect them when they make that judgment.
The controversial law requires ID for absentee voting, establishes limits on ballot drop boxes, and prohibits water and food from being passed out to voters waiting in line. The governor claims it strengthens voter integrity and expands early voting. The longest-serving member of Florida's congressional delegation, Democratic Representative Alcee Hastings, passed away at the age of 84.
Congressman Hastings was a dedicated public servant and leader. We are very thankful for his service and contributions.
Palm Beach County Commissioner Mac Bernard requested a moment of silence for Hastings, who was a civil rights activist and Florida's first black federal judge. In the 1980s, Hastings was removed from the federal bench over a bribery scandal. He served in Congress since 1993, and his passing narrows the Democrats' majority in the House. A former HUD official with the Trump administration has been penalized for violating a law prohibiting executive branch employees from engaging in political activities while on duty. Lynn Patton is barred from federal employment for 4 years over a video featuring public housing residents she produced for the 2020 Republican National Convention. The State Department's considering joining a boycott of the 2022 Beijing Olympics over recent human rights violations and genocide in China. Spokesman Ned Price said the U.S. is discussing the matter with other countries.
We're talking about 2022, and we are still in April of 2021, so these games remain some time away. I wouldn't want to put a time frame on it, but these discussions are underway.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
At least 4,200 Brazilians died from COVID-19 yesterday, taking Brazil's total death toll, the world's second highest only after the United States, to nearly 337,000. With almost 87,000 new infections reported yesterday, epidemiologists fear a record 100,000 Brazilians could lose their lives this month alone. Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, continues to resist imposing a lockdown and continues to downplay the pandemic's intensity. Miguel Lago is the executive director of Brazil's Institute for Health Policy Studies. He said of the situation, quote, "The fact is the anti-lockdown narrative of President Jair Bolsonaro has won. Mayors and governors are politically prohibited from beefing up social distance policies because they know supporters of the president, including business leaders, will sabotage it." With a population only two-thirds the size of that of the U.S., Brazil is expected to soon overtake the U.S.'s weekly average of deaths. Hospital workers in Oregon are holding vigils today to mark over a year of struggling against COVID-19. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Oregon News Service.
Hospital workers in Portland are calling for action and holding vigils today to mark more than a year of struggle against COVID-19. Members of the Oregon Nurses Association and SEIU Local 49 also want Legacy Health to finish negotiating contracts with their members. ONA and SEIU Local 49 hold a vigil this evening to honor those who lost their lives during the pandemic. Christine Allen is a nurse at the Legacy Unity Center for Behavioral Health and vice chair of ONA's bargaining team. She says nurses feel their concerns aren't heard or suggestions aren't being incorporated in the workplace.
There was instances around COVID-related things where that continued to happen between the nursing staff and Legacy leadership. So it's a continuation of the ongoing problem, which is why we organized in the first place, to ensure that our voices are heard.
About 200 Oregon Nurses Association members at Legacy have been bargaining with management on an initial contract for more than a year. Allen notes the changes due to COVID-19, such as virtual meetings rather than in-person, have prolonged the bargaining process. Spokesperson Brian Tarrett says Legacy Health has been working collaboratively with union leadership to ensure employees are competitively and fairly compensated and have a safe working environment. In addition to the vigil, SEIU Local 49 is holding an information picket for its 800 Legacy Emanuel members in negotiations for their new contract for about 7 months. Sunita Patel cleans rooms on the Environmental Services team at Legacy Emanuel Medical Center, where she's worked for 18 years. She says workers haven't received hazard pay during the pandemic, and she and her colleagues had their daily work shifts cut to 7.5 hours.
What we're doing, the work are maybe 12 hours. I have 26 rooms in my unit, which is almost full every day, like there's overflow today too. We can't say to patients, hey, we can't clean your room.
A Legacy Health spokesman says the company respects SEIU Local 49's right to engage in protected union activity. Patel says two crucial parts of their contract are making sure health care is affordable and that workers receive pay raises. The information picket is at Legacy Emanuel Medical Center starting at 11 a.m. The candlelight vigil is at the Unity Center for Behavioral Health at 6 p.m. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our reporting on the Clean Energy for All suite of bills in the Oregon Legislature. Stay tuned at 5:45. We'll hear News from the Boo with Jenna Yokoyama. That's your look at the news inside KBOO. Tonight's weather will include cloudy skies, some light rain, and a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a high of 56. Today in history, in 1890, journalist and activist Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was born. Her most influential book was The Everglades, River of Grass, which redefined the popular public conception of the Everglades as a beautiful region of wetlands instead of a worthless swamp. The quote of the day is from Douglas, who said, quote, "Don't think it is enough to attend meetings and sit there like a lump. Speak up, learn to talk clearly and forcefully in public. Speak simply and not too long at a time, always from sound preparation and knowledge. Be a nuisance where it counts, but don't be a bore at any time. Do your part to inform and stimulate the public to join your action. Be depressed, discouraged, and disappointed at failure and the disheartening effects of ignorance, greed, corruption, and bad politics, but never give up." The murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin continues this week with more testimony. The country watched as Chauvin kneeled on George Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes in May of 2020. Los Angeles Police Sergeant Jody Steger took the stand Tuesday afternoon as the state's expert witness on the use of force. She concluded in her testimony that though the use of force by four officers at the scene was initially justified, as soon as Floyd stopped resisting arrest, Chauvin's use of force was no longer acceptable. For more, we go to Georgia Fort with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Los Angeles Police Sergeant Jody Steger took the stand Tuesday afternoon as the state's expert witness on use of force. Having done extensive research on use of force policies nationwide, Steger concluded that Derek Chauvin's use of force on George Floyd was excessive. Steger said initially when Floyd was resisting arrest, the officers were justified in their use of force.
However, once he was placed in the prone position on the ground, he slowly ceased his resistance, and at that point, the officers, ex-officers, I should say, they should have slowed down or stopped their force as well.
Sergeant Steger was still being questioned by the state when the judge abruptly ended court an hour early. Meanwhile, outside the courtroom, Reverend Al Sharpton held a public prayer followed by remarks from George Floyd's family, including his brother, Philonis.
After we get the verdict and we get this conviction, we'll be able to breathe.
Court is scheduled to resume at 9:30. However, more pretrial hearings are scheduled Wednesday before court. The judge has stated he plans to make a ruling on the testimony of George Floyd's friend Maurice Hall, who asked to plead the fifth in fear that his testimony could be incriminating. Hall was with Floyd when he died and is currently in jail on charges unrelated to Mr. Floyd's death. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
Native organizations are concerned about a U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in a case challenging the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native organizations, including the National Indian Child Welfare Association and the Native American Rights Fund, are concerned about a U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. On Tuesday, a full court decision in Brackeen v. Holland was published in a case challenging the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act. The court recognized ICWA is generally within the authority of Congress, but the organizations are concerned aspects of the opinion misunderstand the unique relationships between the U.S. and tribes. In a statement, the Protect ICWA campaign, which includes the two organizations along with the Association of American Indian Affairs and the National Congress of American Indians, said they're still analyzing the decision and its complexity. The opinion is 325 pages long. The organizations and a number of tribes are fighting to protect the Indian Child Welfare Act. The law is intended to keep Native children with Native families. Supporters of ICWA say it's in the best interest of Indian children and families and vow to continue efforts to protect the law. In her first official trip as Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland hosted a meeting with tribal leaders. The Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr reports.
Haaland spent Tuesday in Albuquerque, meeting with the governors of 9 Pueblo communities in New Mexico. She touted the unprecedented amount of funding, $20 billion, set aside for tribes in the coronavirus relief package, and said the Biden administration is committed to restoring a nation-to-nation relationship with tribes.
That means every bureau and every office must think about our country's trust obligations to Indian tribes.
The governors brought a range of issues to the table, from water rights to challenges tribal police face in dealing with crime by non-Native people on tribal land. Governor Craig Quenchello of Picarice Pueblo asked Haaland to address the severe underfunding of the Federal Indian Health Service.
It's time that we hold IHS responsible to provide us with equal health care as everybody else. I ask for your support in that.
On Thursday, Haaland will travel to southeast Utah. She'll meet with tribal leaders and other local stakeholders about the future of national monuments at Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. For National Native News, I'm Savannah Marr.
The Navajo Nation announced Tuesday it's recorded a case of the COVID-19 variant first identified in California. During a virtual town hall, tribal leaders and health officials discussed the variant, vaccination efforts, and urged residents to continue to take precautions. Emma Gibson has more.
COVID-19 cases are low compared to this winter, but Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez is warning of a possible uptick in cases. Nez says the variant is highly infectious and has been identified in the states surrounding the nation. But he says contact tracers in the nation didn't find other cases.
We're going to stay in orange level. Even though the numbers are low and we're in yellow, we're going to take slow steps, being very cautious here and reopening.
The nation is currently under a stay-at-home order, but Nez emphasized businesses will still be open. Last week, the nation announced it identified the variant first found in the United Kingdom. The person had already had 2 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine and didn't need to be hospitalized. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
House lawmakers in North Dakota passed a bill Tuesday which requires Native American history to be taught in school. KFYR reports students in 4th, 8th, and high school would have courses on history of the 5 federally recognized tribes in North Dakota if the bill is signed into law. It already passed the Senate. The chambers will now work out differences. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Dentists and dental hygienists have a key community role in spotting child abuse. When poor oral health, like tooth decay, is going unaddressed by the parent or caregiver, it could be a sign that the child is being neglected or even abused. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story with the Public News Service.
April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and dentists can play a key role in spotting signs that something may be wrong in a child's life. Dental hygienist Jennifer Hash, director of Shawnee Christian Healthcare Center in Louisville, explains when poor oral health, infection, or tooth decay are going unaddressed by a parent or caregiver, that could possibly be a red flag for abuse or neglect.
It has been a stressful year, so we know that there's likely a lot of child abuse happening that's not getting caught right now. And if they are coming to the dental office, I think it's an opportunity for us to intervene.
A virtual training on April 9th aims to help oral health professionals recognize signs of abuse. They can register for the training at kyoralhealthcoalition.org/event. A new online toolkit developed by the COSAIR charities Face It Movement and Delta Dental of Kentucky also has tips on how to help people in dental offices spot signs of child abuse. It's online at faceitabuse.org/health-professionals. More than 20,000 Kentucky children were victims of child abuse or neglect in 2019, the highest rate in the nation. Kara Ferris with Delta Dental says because more than half of a child's injuries from abuse involve the head or neck, dentists and hygienists are in a unique position to ask important questions.
And the whole goal is to train them on what to ask, how to ask these questions without throwing any red flags to the child or to the parent.
According to the latest federal report, in 2019, Kentucky had the highest rate of child victims of maltreatment for the third year in a row. Keith Inman of CoSare Charities, a group spearheading child abuse awareness efforts statewide, believes the situation in Kentucky is a public health crisis that requires the same level of resources and attention being given to the coronavirus.
Unless more people know the warnings, it's going to continue. So I want us to spend as much time, effort on this pandemic as we have on current pandemic.
Inman adds the 10-4 rule can help spot unusual bruising on kids. 10-4 stands for bruises on the torso, ears, and neck on any child 4 years of age or younger, or bruising anywhere on an infant who is not yet taking steps. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants some other vaccines.
While the vaccine protects from COVID at least 3 out of 4 times, it makes us a lot more susceptible to spring fever. Get out, get together, get close after this year-long winter of masks and isolation. People going out more, but many businesses will not return. Multnomah County goes back into high risk on Friday, though Governor Brown has tweaked the risk levels so more businesses throughout the state can stay open. Some jobs coming back, mostly those dealing face-to-face with people, with a lot more applying for each one. While businesses now know they don't have to rent office space, but can make us work from our own apartments, assuming we still have one. The number of billionaires in the world increased 30% in just 1 year. There's a vaccine for too much money and too few hands, higher tax rates and fewer loopholes, but the sickest and wealthiest control the entity, the federal government, that could distribute the cure. With so many pandemics around, economic injustice, racial injustice, ecological ignorance, greed, we need to foster our immunity with friendship, optimism, and effort. So many flowers blossoming, you know there will be fruit. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
An innovation lab in Georgia is working to speed up the transition to clean transportation by testing self-driving electric scooters, a solar road, and other exciting new technologies. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At Curiosity Lab in Peachtree Corners, Georgia, companies are testing new transportation technologies. For example, you can summon an electric scooter and it will roll up, riderless, and ready for you to hop on.
Think Uber, but for an e-scooter. You pull up the app, you call it, the e-scooter drives to you.
Brandon Branham is Chief Technology Officer for the City of Peachtree Corners, which owns Curiosity Lab. The lab is located within a technology park and allows companies, free of charge, to see how their products perform in a real-world setting. The property includes a 1.5-mile stretch of road that's used as a test track for technologies like the scooters and self-driving electric shuttles. And now, part of the track is a solar road. It's embedded with solar panels that people can walk and drive on.
And they adhere right on top of the roadway so you don't have to bust up the asphalt.
Branham says the manufacturer is evaluating how the solar road performs with pedestrians, bikes, and cars, and changing weather conditions.
Can it hold up on a roadway? What happens when it gets really hot? What happens when it rains?
The data that companies gather at Curiosity Lab can help improve emerging technologies, and that can help speed the transition to a cleaner transportation future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 7th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, the producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Eric Tegadoff, Georgia Fort, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Three bills in the Oregon legislature aim to pave a path for a clean energy future for the state. They're supported by the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign and address a variety of interconnected issues, from the need for more affordable utility bills to preparing for 100% clean energy with an eye toward environmental and racial justice. I spoke with Nikita Daryanani, the Climate and Energy Policy Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color, to learn more about the effort.
So the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign broadly is working on three bills in the state legislature that pertain to clean energy this session. So I want to talk through them because they each address a different facet of that issue. So to start, let's talk about House Bill 2021, Clean Energy for All. What does that bill do?
Yeah, so you're right. HB 2021 is part of a suite of bills driven by the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign. So it sets a 100% clean energy standard for the state of Oregon. So it requires that by 2040, Oregon's utility customers will be powered 100% by non-emitting resources. So this just means energy resources that don't emit greenhouse gases. And it was really born out of a vision for a clean energy future that is grounded in environmental justice, focusing on maximizing benefits to low-income communities of color and reducing harm to these communities as well. And I think what's important here is that the transition to clean energy will happen. So it's a chance for us to make sure that those who are the most impacted by our current energy system can share in the benefits of its transition. So these are benefits like reduction in pollution, but also job creation and resilience through local clean energy projects. So it's a great step forward to decarbonizing Oregon, reducing emissions from energy generation, and is also a chance to ensure economic development and jobs are happening locally.
I'm interested in the part where you said that the transition to clean energy is going to happen, but this is an opportunity to be intentional about how we want it to look in Oregon.
Yeah, right. So I think to start off with, I think we can talk about the federal government's efforts. So I think it's fair to say we'll see clean energy and infrastructure investments from the federal government. I know that the Biden administration is focusing on climate change and has made the claim to set a nationwide 100% clean energy standard, but I don't think we know when that will be or when that fight will take place. I think that's why it's great that Oregon is looking to take action as a state so that when the transition to clean energy is moving forward, that we can ensure that the people who are at the front lines of climate change and the poorest people in our state and the most impacted can benefit from it. So we're really setting the groundwork for an equitable energy system. And so this is an opportunity to do that in a way that that benefits and lifts up the people who are traditionally left behind by environmental policy and energy.
So then there's the second of the three bills, House Bill 2475, Energy Affordability. Now there's been a renewed focus on the burden of energy bills since the pandemic hit and people's, you know, economic situations have shifted massively. How does that bill tie the issue of the burden of energy bills to the idea of clean energy?
Yeah, so HB 2475, or the Oregon Energy Affordability Act, basically allows the Public Utilities Commission, or the PUC, which is a state
an Oregon state agency that is the governing body that regulates the biggest utilities in Oregon, and allows those utilities to create a low-income rate class and consider environmental justice factors and energy burden when they are setting rates for different customers for energy for their utilities. So energy burden is typically defined as the percentage of your household income that's spent on energy costs. So this bill is really working to reduce energy burden for those who are the most burdened by energy bills. Everyone should be able to pay their utility bills. So I think what's important about this bill is that it allows us to take into consideration the other factors that homes and families are going through, and the other costs that they might have. So, you know, rent and food and transportation, and it kind of takes the load off of those expenses, because people need electricity and energy in their homes to survive and to live and to thrive and feed their families. So this bill helps to make that happen by, you know, allowing the regulatory agency a tool to make rates specific for low income folks. And I think the way that this ties into clean energy is that renewable energy now is cheap. It's cheap, and so it can help reduce people's energy bills. And so it's important. I think it works really well together with all of the other two bills in our campaign, in that we're addressing sort of the main pieces of an inequitable energy system. So we're hitting energy affordability in a way that builds equity in our energy system.
And then for the third one, it's House Bill 2842, which pertains to healthy homes. And that bill would support home improvements in low-income households across Oregon. Why is that a critical goal for the state at this moment?
Yeah, I think this moment really has illuminated how important it is for folks to be healthy and how important public health is. And a lot of the homes in Oregon are pretty old. I think 54% of Oregonians live in housing that's built before 1978. And then I think when the pandemic hit, I think it's really important that we are focusing on not just the public health risks that folks might have when they leave their homes, but also the public health and health hazards that folks might be experiencing inside their homes, especially important during a pandemic that has required many of us to stay inside our homes. So House Bill 2842, the Healthy Homes Bill, will create a fund or a program within the Oregon Health Authority. So this is another state agency within Oregon, basically distributing grants to local housing authorities or nonprofits or local governments to help fund some of the really important upgrades and repairs that can cause major hazards to folks living in their homes. So this can include radon or lead abatement in homes, or fire hardening, or other upgrades that folks might have, removal of allergy triggers or asthma triggers. Additionally, I think what's really important, especially given the recent wildfires in Oregon, is this bill could also help fund installations of air purification systems in homes, so that when there are wildfires, folks are safe from wildfire smoke in their homes, and that's not a trigger to their chronic illnesses or impacting their lungs. So I think now, especially given the climate disasters that Oregon has faced, in addition to the public health crisis and economic crisis that the pandemic has caused, I think it's made it even more clear that folks should have homes and houses that are healthy and safe and protect them from outside.
As you mentioned earlier, you work as the Climate and Energy Policy Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color. In advocating for legislation on this topic and the bills that we've discussed, do you encounter any misconceptions when it comes to your work or the benefits of this kind of legislation?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think what's
been really exciting specifically about this bill is that it's been really collaborative. So we haven't run into that sort of misconception quite yet, because this bill and the campaign at large is focused on finding shared common ground and really framing things in a way that demonstrate how broad benefits from clean energy and healthy homes and energy affordability can be throughout Oregon and in coastal communities, rural communities, urban communities, poor and working class communities. So the benefits are very broad and wide reaching. And so I think that has been really important in bridging and finding shared common ground, especially between Republican and Democrat legislators, environmental groups, environmental justice advocates, such as the ones that I work with, the clean energy industry as a whole. So we have a list of all the organizations on our website who are supportive or endorsing the campaign. And you can see just from that how broad the support is. And to me, this means that opportunities in clean energy is something that so many people can get behind and understand and are coalescing around. And it means that the benefits that come with it are truly needed in communities throughout Oregon.
Right. The energy affordability bill passed the State House with bipartisan support on the 16th, isn't that right?
Yeah, it did, which is great news. And now we'll head over to the Senate.
So broadly speaking, and we've touched on this some, but what are the kinds of benefits that Oregons can expect to see in the future if these bills are passed?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, I think the reduction of emissions from energy generation is a big benefit, and this is of course will be tied to a reduction in pollution as well, but also job creation and resilience through local clean energy projects. So right now, HB 2021 is in its public comment phase, and so it had a hearing yesterday. And there are a few improvements that definitely need to be made in the first round of amendments. And I think those improvements largely center around strengthening some of the benefits that I've mentioned. So ensuring that there are strong labor standards to make sure that women and femmes and folks from marginalized communities and people of color have access to local well-paying jobs in clean energy, and that they are receiving those jobs to build our clean energy future. And then also the other benefits, like I mentioned, are local community-based clean energy projects, which we have the opportunity to really build out in HB 2021. And these are projects that are local. They might be community owned. They might generate electricity that's community owned. It allows for more jobs locally, as well as communities to be more resilient in the face of disaster. Say the fact that these energy systems are local and community based. Can make it so that they are protected from disasters that are happening in other parts of the state or nearby, and that folks can have access that's uninterrupted to electricity or essential services during these disasters. And then more broadly, I think local community-based energy projects can also help with building wealth in the communities that need it the most. And the last thing I'll say about community energy projects is that having these small-scale projects can be they have other benefits beyond economic development and resilience as well. And these can depend really on the community itself. So local energy projects, I think, have the flexibility of meeting and addressing community needs depending on what those are. And I think through HB 2021, I'm hopeful that we can build that piece out to make it really strong and make it so that we are increasing the capacity for local clean energy projects throughout Oregon in many different communities that could really benefit from it. So to sum up, I think some of those benefits are local energy projects, resilience, and good, well-paying jobs in the clean energy sector. So that's another piece that I think in the weeks moving forward, we're going to be really working together to ensure that labor standards are strong in that they're providing prevailing wages for folks who are doing this work and benefits and things like that. So I think those are some of the benefits that a clean energy future can have, and some of the opportunities to see those benefits happen that HB 2021 is offering us.
So if listeners are interested in learning more about these bills, about the campaign, about your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, you can learn more by heading to cleanenergyoregon.org. This is the campaign website. You can follow the campaign on social media as well, Oregon Clean Energy on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Like I mentioned, the HB 2021 is still being worked on and still moving through the legislature. So you can sign up through the website and follow us online to keep updated on where things are with that bill, as well as the other two bills that are part of the campaign. Additionally, if you're interested in learning more about the work that my organization, the Coalition of Communities of Color, does, you can check us out at coalitioncommunitiescolor.org, Color Coalition on Twitter, and we're on Facebook as well.
Very cool. Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't get to cover yet?
No, I think the main important piece that I think, again, is really exciting to me is the frontline community-driven effort. And this is, I think what we're doing with this campaign is really important, especially for folks who have been impacted by recent wildfires, power outages through the ice storm, the pandemic, and the economic crisis. And I think that HB 2021, as well as the other two bills, can really help us build back in a way that is equitable and serving the needs of those who are most impacted first and worst. So I think it's a really incredible opportunity, and I'm really excited to be part of it and to work alongside the organizations that are putting this forward. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, Nikita. I really appreciate it.
That was Nikita Daryanani, the Climate and Energy Policy Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color, speaking about three bills in the Oregon Legislature aimed at a clean energy future for the state. The bills are House Bill 2021, Clean Energy for All, House Bill 2475, Energy Affordability, and House Bill 2842, Healthy Homes.